It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me joins us to talk about his life's other great passion, running.
First, 13-year-old Barron County resident Jamie Kloss was found alive yesterday after being missing for nearly 3 months. Kloss was abducted after her parents were murdered at their home in mid-October.
Kloss was found in Gordon, about 65 miles north of Barron. After apparently escaping from her kidnapper, she sought help from a woman walking her dog. A 911 call brought police to the scene, and they arrested 21-year-old Jake Thomas Patterson in connection with the kidnapping shortly thereafter.
In a few minutes, we'll talk with a WPR reporter about the latest details on the case being released by law enforcement. First, State Representative Romaine Quinn joins us. He's a Republican representing the state's 75th Assembly District, which includes Barron County. Representative Quinn, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How are you feeling today after getting the news that Jamie was found alive?
Oh, you can't even explain it. It's relieved. It's excited. It's thankful. So many emotions for so many people in our community and just grateful. Absolutely grateful.
Now, of course, this was a national story, but it was personal for many of the people in your district. Can you talk about the response you've seen in and around the Barron community over the last 3 months that Jamie's been missing?
Well, our community is awesome, and we showed this displacement, when we had our tornado issue last summer and now this time, whether it's the thousands of volunteers where we searched cornfields and swamps to all the local businesses that kept their agents, federal agents, and local fed during the initial searches, and just, our county sheriff and all of our law enforcement, and everyone's been so giving and caring and understanding, and I just couldn't be more proud of where I live and where I come from and the families and communities that pull together through this.
There were a lot of different law enforcement agencies, as you talked about, that were involved in this case, from the FBI to the local sheriff's department. How do you think the coordination between all of those groups went from the moment that Jamie was missing until she was found yesterday?
From everything that I can tell in talking with numerous people, it was seamless. And so credit, again, to Chris Fitzgerald, our sheriff, and his team, everyone at Barron County, and of course, the Department of Justice, former Attorney General Brad Schimel was making sure we had everything we needed. And I just can't say enough to all our men and women in uniform that truly responded in an awesome fashion, and we're so grateful.
Had a chance to watch some of the press conference this morning with Sheriff Fitzgerald, and he seemed to be so relieved and so happy, as if it was his own daughter, but certainly a member of the community. How great is that to see that law enforcement was so involved and really so into not only trying to find Jamie, but also thinking about it from the aspect of what if it was their daughter that was missing or their child?
Well, that's who we are. That's who our community is. We're tight-knit. We're close. Everyone looks out for everyone. And, yes, this was especially took a toll on Sheriff as well, because we all know families with children this age, and that's what you do as a leader, is you put yourself in your community's shoes and you act accordingly, and I think he did, and the rest of our law enforcement community, and that's why it's such a great day, and that's why everyone across the county is relieved.
And finally, anything else you're going to be watching in your district in the coming days as it relates to this case?
Well, we're watching to see what charges are finally filed, and I have absolute confidence in our new DA, Brian Wright, to make sure that justice is served and swiftly done so, and I think that will be the final conclusion, so the family can really start having some closure on this, because remember, it's not just about finding Jamie. Two people were murdered, and it's a sad day, but it's a grateful day, and we're excited going forward to put this chapter behind us.
Representative Quinn, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Now, WPR's Eau Claire reporter Rich Kramer has been spending the day in Barron getting the latest details. Rich, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by taking a listen to Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald talking about how he felt when getting the news that Jamie Kloss was found alive in Douglas County.
It was first unreal, and is it true? And then when we confirmed with Sheriff Dalbeck's team that it's confirmed it was her, you know, my legs started to shake, man. It was awesome. It was just the stress and relief. I mean, it was just, it was awesome. I don't have a different word. I mean, it's just fabulous. It was just great.
That, of course, was Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald talking about the feeling he had when Jamie Kloss was found. What has been the mood like for not only Fitzgerald, but a lot of the other county officials?
Well, I just have to go back to what Representative Quinn said. I mean, there is literally a sense of giddiness. I've heard three people use that word today. It's just been such a trying time for the community. And as the representative mentioned, it is a really tight-knit community, but this, if anything, has brought people closer together. And the thing that really surprised me throughout the whole experience was there was so much hope. And when someone's missing for that long after such a tragic crime was committed, some people might become a little cynical, but I have not seen a speck of that among any of the people that I've talked to all throughout the process here in Barron.
What do we know right now about the moment Jamie was found? How did things play out?
Well, according to the Douglas County Sheriff's Department, who was at the press conference with the Barron County Sheriff's Department, Jamie Kloss escaped from the house. She was in Gordon, Wisconsin, which is a small town about 70 miles to the north of Barron. And she escaped. She ran. There was a woman walking her dog nearby, and Jamie Kloss came upon this woman, and the woman brought her to a nearby house. They called 911, and about 11 minutes later, I'm told, is when deputies found the suspect. I guess he was in a car. They're not sure. There haven't been any details about where he might have been going, if he was trying to escape, if he was looking for her. There's a lot of questions still, but that's the sheriff's department up in Douglas County called Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald, and he put out a Facebook post, and that's when this thing just blew up last night.
Well, you spoke about the suspect, Jake Thomas Patterson. He was arrested about 10 minutes after responding at the police responding to a 911 call. What do we know about him and any relationship that he may have had with the Kloss family?
They're being careful with the details at this point. We'll see if there's more information at 4 p.m. with the second press conference of the day. But, he's from Gordon. We know that. And the sheriff in Barron County, Sheriff Fitzgerald, did say that there is a connection to Barron County. He didn't elaborate on that. But he doesn't have a criminal record as far, not in Wisconsin anyway. And I even talked with some of the two aunts of Jamie Kloss, and they said they had never heard of this fella, never seen a picture of him until the mugshot was passed out among the press today. So it's really strange. I mean, it's there's a lot of questions that are still being asked.
Now, this case has gotten tons of attention and thousands of tips came in, but ultimately it took an escape by Jamie Kloss herself to bring it to a close. Can you help us look back and remind us how this investigation played out?
Sure. Mid-October, I think it was the 15th or so, we started hearing about this double homicide. And then soon after that, the sheriff's department said that there's this 13-year-old girl that's missing. And since then, there was a lot of media attention then. Since then, the sheriff's department has been really good about doing doing a lot of updates. So they've been very proactive about getting the word out in the media. And the sheriff today actually credited that communication with helping get her face out there, get her name out there. It was said that this woman was walking their dog, and when Jamie Kloss came upon her, also the homeowner where they brought her to and called the authorities, they instantly recognized. So, I mean, that's 70 miles to the north. These are rural communities. It's kind of cool that everybody in this area and even beyond knows who she is. So there's just a lot of media attention. There were a couple of gatherings of hope that have happened. And, of course, Chris Cruzy, who's one of the local celebrities, he was on The Voice, came in second place, used that platform to get the word out as well. So there's been a lot of attention to his case. And today, it seems like the media attention is at the peak. I mean, I've never seen so many reporters in one place. And I think that's because, you know, it's unfortunately, a lot of times these situations don't have the happy ending that we've got today. I mean, happy, all things considered, but the community is really glad that she's coming home.
And finally, what information are police working on gathering today?
Well, Jamie Kloss is talking with investigators. I mean, she's been cleared from the hospital. Sheriff Fitzgerald said that she's going to be coming home sometime today. He expects, he's not positive on that, but so they're interviewing Jamie, they're interviewing the suspect, and I'm eager to see what more information is released at 4 p.m. So there's a lot of unknowns yet, and everybody wants to know how and why this happened.
Rich, thanks so much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He joins us on the phone from Barron to talk about 13-year-old Jamie Kloss being found alive yesterday after being missing for the last 3 months.
Our next guest is a familiar voice for public radio listeners. You know Peter Sagal as the host of NPR's popular quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What you might not know about him is that he's also an avid runner, having completed 14 marathons across the United States, a lot of 5 and 10Ks, and a lot of jogs around the neighborhood, too.
In a new book, he reflects on how running helped him through the darkest period of his life, as well as some of the other lessons he learned over the course of thousands of miles on the run.
Peter Sagal is the author of The Incomplete Book of Running. He joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Peter, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back with you guys. How are you?
Well, really good. Now, you started running in your teen years, but you say it wasn't until later, around age 40, that you turned from someone who runs into a runner. What was the difference there?
The difference is it's when you're older, when you're approaching middle age, it's much easier to imagine that you were going to die,
okay,
frankly, which is more of an abstract thought at the age of 15. But when I turned 40, this was some years ago, it became more and more concrete, and I decided, in the way that a lot of people do, I think this is a fairly typical thing as people get toward middle age, man and woman, to say, I better do something, I better get out there, I better have more experiences and prove that I'm still alive. So I decided to run a marathon, which I did. But what is less typical, I think, is what I did, much to my surprise, which is that I finished that first marathon in 2005, and I said to myself, I wonder if I can do that faster. And that started a journey that, brought me here.
Now, you like running, and for someone like me who's not a runner, I don't quite get it. I'll be honest with you. Explain the appeal.
Well, let me ask you a question. When's the last time you tried running?
Oh, man. I mean, I walk fast sometimes, but running, you know, to catch a bus maybe.
Right,
but,
of course.
Like a 100-yard dash, and that's about it.
When you were, did you run, for example, in, say, high school gym? Did your gym teacher make you run laps? No.
Nope.
So you
nope.
can't even... You can't even remember the last time you tried it.
Right, exactly. You got me.
Okay, but you don't like it.
I didn't. Okay, I see where you're going. Don't knock it until I've tried it again.
There's a green eggs and ham here, that you know, happening here, which is that a lot of people, and I think this has to do, frankly, with the situation of our age, as Samuel Johnson might say. As you say, the only time when you might have to run in the life that we live now is when you need to catch a bus or perhaps somebody stole your bag. The fact of the matter is that we, a lot of us, imagine that we don't like to run because we never run. And so it becomes abstract, like, you know, I don't like getting repeatedly punched in the face either. That doesn't happen to me, but I assume it would be bad. And I think that a lot of people in your situation, if they were to try it, to actually go out and run a few blocks, it probably wouldn't be immediately joyful, but it wouldn't be as awful as you might think. And here's the key. If you keep it up, if you get over that initial hump of being out of shape and not used to it, and you keep at it, you don't have to do a lot. You'd be surprised at how quickly, A, you get good at it, and B, it becomes actually enjoyable. For me at this point, it's essential. I can't go, I mean, this is my second day in a row when I speak to you today on Friday without running, and if I don't go running at least by tomorrow, I'll start to go mad.
Now, one thing that really did appeal to me as you talk about running is, you write about when you're in different places, different cities, you use running in part as a way to get out of, you know, the hotel district, the part of town that looks like every other town in the United States, and get out and explore the uniqueness of a community.
Exactly right. And, you know, I've had wonderful runs in Madison. I've had wonderful runs in Milwaukee. And, like, I'll give you an example. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me routinely goes up to Milwaukee to do a show every now and then. And if I didn't get up in the morning of our show and go for a run, I never would probably leave the two blocks between our hotel and the Riverside Theater. And that goes for all the cities we travel to. And that is, I think, it's not just a shame, it's kind of a tragedy. There's a lot of stuff going on out there. And sometimes the best way to find out where you are is to go out and run around in it.
Talking to Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His new book is called The Incomplete Book of Running. You also talk about, and this appeals to me too, the community of runners, the fellowship, a group of people who, you know, you don't care what you look like when you're out and running with these people in a marathon or informally.
Yeah, it's true. And I've run all over the country with all kinds of people, probably, you know, hundreds of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, hundreds, maybe thousands. And it's always great. And this has a little bit to do with the fact that we're all doing the same thing, or as I say in the book, we're all going in the same direction, so it's pretty easy to get along. It's also because the people you meet running, you're not going to spend a tremendous amount of time with them. You're going to go for a run, and then you're all going to say goodbye and go home. One of the great things about running is we all know, we've all heard about the fellowship of sport, right? You know, team spirit. And sometimes when, you know, if you're not an athletic person like myself, that seems like something wonderful yet inaccessible, you know? I mean, I'm never going to be a championship athlete in baseball or anything else. But for those of us who are like me, the threshold for running is so, I guess, low. It's so easy to get into that you can participate in that kind of community of effort, that sort of athletic fraternity or sorority, I guess. And it's just as wonderful as it looks like when you're watching, you know, the Green Bay Packers celebrate. It's just the same, even though, of course, you don't get the live television coverage.
As we mentioned, you write about how running has, in part, helped you get through a dark time in your life, a divorce, kids involved in that divorce. How has running, at least in part, helped you cope with that?
It's something I didn't really understand until I got to the end of it. Because as I'm sure many of the listeners who have experienced this know, when you go through something like this, you find you're totally unprepared, right? All of a sudden, your marriage is breaking up. All of a sudden, you're going to become a divorced dad, which is not anything I ever imagined I ever would be, let alone wanted to be. And you find yourself very unprepared. It's very disorienting. But in the course of writing this book and then talking about it afterwards, one of the things I've realized is that even though at the time when I went through these experiences, I felt completely overwhelmed, it turns out I had been, in a way, preparing for it or training for it through long-distance running, because running gives you, among other things, cardiovascular benefits, lost weight, whatever, it gives you what I call the practice of persistence. I mean, distance running is what we call an endurance sport, like cycling or swimming, and we mean that literally. You have to endure it. It's not as painful as it sounds, but there is endurance involved, and as you practice it, you become better at enduring things. You become better at understanding that anything you're in the middle of, no matter how difficult it seems, you can get to the end of it, that it's going to end. It's not a permanent condition. I mean, a marathon seems really, really long. It's 26 miles, but it's not an infinite number of miles. It will be over. And I discovered that the practice of that prepared me in a way that ended up being very, very valuable for getting through much more difficult and complex things than a simple road race.
NPR listeners may remember you had run the Boston Marathon. You were about, by your best estimate, 100 yards away from the bombs going off. You tell the story in the book, and that's a through line in the book. I don't want to spoil too much of that. I wanted to ask, though, you went back and ran the Boston Marathon again. What was that like? What was that like for you after that?
It was a collective act of defiance. Shortly after the bombing, I was contacted by a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times and asked me about it. And, you know, I had been there. And I was asked if I had any message for the bombers, who at that point no one knew who they were. They hadn't been caught yet. And what I said was couldn't be printed in the Chicago Sun-Times and can't be repeated on public radio. But everybody coming back to run the marathon again in 2014 was expressing that unspeakable sentiment to not just the bombers who by that time had been killed and caught respectively, but to anyone who had even thought for a moment that this crime, this tragedy, would affect our sport, our event. The Boston Marathon, as people might know, is sort of the crown jewel of the annual racing season. It's what we call the amateurs' Olympics. You know, it's a difficult thing to get into, but it can be done by almost anybody with enough training and dedication. And we just weren't going to let the, I'll put it in a Wisconsin-ish way, the sons of guns to take it away from us. And it was an exciting and kind of an important day for everybody in the community.
I don't want people to come away thinking this is all serious stuff here. Can you tell us a little bit about the time and the time you ran a race in your underwear in the middle of winter?
Yeah, it was weird. You know, one of the things that happens with running is people say, well, running's kind of boring, and they're not entirely wrong. So out there in the world, there are a lot of people who are coming up with ways to add levels of interest. There are zombie runs where people who are dressed as zombies trace you. There are survival runs where you have to go through literally fire. This is called the Cupid Undies Run, which is a fundraiser for the Children's Tumor Foundation. And what they require you to do is run just a mile, but do it in your underwear, preferably red, on Valentine's Day, which, as you may know, is in the winter. So, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people end up doing rather silly things they didn't anticipate once they get divorced. In my case, I found myself running down the streets of St. Louis in my underwear. There are photos of this on the internet, and I do not encourage anyone to look them up.
Peter, 30 seconds or so, get me running. Get the non-runners running.
You need to get outside. Our lives are lived sitting in chairs, in cars, in offices, staring at things or listening to things. That is not how we were designed or how we evolved to live. And the act of running, which is something that everyone, to coin a phrase, was born to do, is a way to get back to the person who you were supposed to be. And it's accessible to anyone. Just go outside.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you so much.
Peter Sagal is the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We've been talking about his new book, The Incomplete Book of Running. Darrell, has this ever happened to you? You're cooking at home. Maybe you're making some chicken. You look down at, you know, kind of a boring-looking meal and think, there's got to be a way to give this thing a little pizzazz. So you open up the spice cabinet, but you're overwhelmed by a monolith of flavor-enhancing options at your disposal. So you just throw some salt and pepper on it, call it a day, and think, maybe next time I'll have the courage to embark on an exciting spice odyssey.
All right, Rob. I'm not sure that exact scenario has happened to me, but I get where you're coming from. And you're in luck, though, because Dr. Stu is here to help. Dr. Stuart Fairmond is a food scientist, and his latest book is called Spice: Understand the Science of Spice, Create Exciting New Blends, and Revolutionize Your Cooking.
He joins us now on Food Friday to help us explore the diverse world of spices and to give us some tips on how to spice up our home cooking. Dr. Stu, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me back. I love the 2001 theme tune. That's befitting spice, I think.
Exactly. You've got credit to our producer, Carl Christensen, for that one. Now, we've talked to you about meat before and veggies and baking science. What led you to tackle now spices as your next mission?
Well, I don't know about you, but if you go in the kitchen, there's one area of the kitchen that I think we're most scared of, and that is when it comes to the spice rack I've got a cupboard with lots of spice jars in. And my whole thing is about using science to help us cook better and to use our whole kitchen and cooking to help us understand science better. And spices, they're just one of those things that we don't get. We just don't. They're scary. They're these things that you buy a jar once for a recipe and then you use it and then you've no idea what to do with it. It stays in the back of your cupboard and it just gathers dust there for about 4 years. So I'm all about busting myths and making things easy for us in the kitchen by just using a bit of science. And so spice seemed to be one of those things. There wasn't really anything out there. There wasn't really a book or anything that kind of looked at it from the science angle, and so I thought, let's give that a go.
Now, this may seem obvious to some people, but how would you define what a spice is?
It's not that obvious, actually, because I think you might even get chefs that disagree about what a spice is and what a spice isn't. But a spice, and actually, yeah, it does depend who you ask. And sometimes some people call bay a spice, or it isn't a spice, or is garlic a spice, or is garlic not a spice. But essentially, a spice is any part of a plant that you use in small quantities primarily for its flavor, unless it's a green leafy bit, in which case we usually call it an herb.
And speaking of the science of spices, you break down spices into kind of a periodic table based on some of their flavor properties, their chemistry, how they play with each other. Nutshell, how do you divvy up the world of spices?
Yeah, we've got 12 groups here. Now, spices, they've got weird names. If you're from a kind of a Western culture, be it North America or Northern Europe or something, I wasn't taught how to cook with spices. And so there are these scary things with weird names, and how on earth do I think about them? So is there a way in which we can simplify it so that we know that, this spice is going to taste a bit like this, or this spice goes with this kind of dish? And so I researched into, I think we've got about 50 odd, something like 50 of the most common spices that are used in the kitchen. And with my science hat on, I wanted to find out what is it in each of those spices that gives it its core principal flavor. And so I've found out for all the spices, took a lot of research, what the flavor compounds are, which are the chemicals inside the food that give it its taste and give it its aroma, its flavor. Now, lots of things, spices included, will have hundreds of these things, hundreds of different flavor compounds, but there's going to be one, two, three, or four that will have the core flavor. That will make it give it, say, a warm kind of earthy flavor, or a kind of a citrusy flavor, or something floral perhaps. And by picking those out and finding out what they are, you discover that lots of spices have similar or the same flavor compounds as their primary flavor. And so by doing that, by getting all the spices and sort of compiling all the data, I could group them fairly nicely into 12 groups based on what their main flavor compound is.
Can you give us a little bit of information on how spices were used throughout history?
Yeah, spices have been used for, we don't know when we first started using spices, but it seems to be from as soon as we started climbing out of trees and cooking things, we discovered spices. And we think perhaps we used leaves maybe to wrap food or meat in, and then we discovered it kind of had a flavor. We thought, ooh, that's good. But essentially throughout history, we've considered them to have medicinal value and to be something that is of value. So in many parts of history, we've actually considered spices to be so precious that we've used them as a currency. So peppercorns, for example, have been used as a currency in the past. There have been wars fought over nutmeg between the British and the Dutch. Over about 100 years or so, thousands of people lost their lives fighting over the rights for some islands in Indonesia that had the nutmeg trees in, just so that you could have that commodity. And we've got the spice routes, which are roads that have crossed all throughout Europe and into Asia, where we've traded spices. And also salt as well. Salt isn't a spice, but it has been traded a lot in the past because they're these things that are extremely potent. They're packed and they're loaded with substances that give it flavor. And they're unusual. They're unusual to get these little packets of flavor in such high intensity. And so we've regarded them as being something that's precious and something to be preserved.
Talking to Stuart Faramond, a.k.a. Dr. Stu, about his new book, Spice, all about the science of spice. Now, getting to some of our practical use of spices, I think we've all been here. How long has this jar been in the cabinet? Is it still good? Is it still going to taste good? You give some guidelines for a lot of the different spices, but do you have any rules of thumb for us for when to use that spice by?
Well, one of the great things about spices is they do last a very long time, which is why they've been used as a currency in the past. So if you keep whole spices dry and fairly cool and in the dark, they will last for, many spices will last for several years and they'll still be okay. The problem comes is when you actually you grind them into a powder. Now, this is a mistake that I think a lot of people do, and it puts them off using spices because the ground spice isn't as good as the whole spice. And if you can persuade yourself that it's worth going and getting some whole spice, so let's just say coriander, go and get the coriander seeds rather than the ground coriander and grind it up. And the easiest way to do this is to get a little coffee bean grinder. And so you can use it for your coffee as well. And then put your spices in there, blitz it up about maybe 3, 4, 5 seconds. And then you've got your very own ground spice. Because the problem is, as soon as you've ground it, it's starting to lose its flavor. The flavor, they come from the flavor compounds, which are in the oils of the spice itself. As soon as you've ground it, you've started to release those oils, you start to release those flavors. But over time, they will evaporate, they will break down, they'll be lost. So unfortunately, ground spices, they're easier to use, but they don't last as long. So I would say each spice will be a little bit different. I definitely wouldn't keep my ground spices more than a year, but you could keep whole spices, I would say for longer than that. If you keep them well, you could probably keep them 2 or 3 years.
We're exploring the diverse world of spices with Dr. Stuart Faramond. He is a food scientist and the author of Spice, Understanding the Science of Spice, Create Exciting New Blends, and Revolutionize Your Cooking.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 on this Food Friday conversation. What spices do you like to cook with when you're eating? When it comes to spice, tell us what you want, what you really, really want. Or do you have a question for Dr. Stu about cooking with spices? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Dr. Stuart Faramond, a food scientist and the author of Spice, Understand the Science of Spice, Create New Exciting Blends, Exciting New Blends, and Revolutionize Your Cooking.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your spice-related comments, recipes, experiences, and questions. Is there a particular spice or spice blend you'd like to ask Dr. Stu about? Do you have something you got, as Dr. Stu was saying earlier, for a particular recipe, and you're thinking, what the heck do I do with that now? I used a few pinches of it. I got a whole jar. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. You can find a recipe. We'll get into that in a minute at WPR.org/Food Friday.
We'll go right to the phones. Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer. Good afternoon, Deborah. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. Oh, I love garlic, and I can't eat anything. Or let's just say I don't eat anything without putting a ton of garlic and cayenne pepper on it. And I'm wondering why when I use fresh garlic, because I usually use the powdered stuff, but when I use fresh garlic, it's not as potent tasting. I can't really taste the garlic flavor. So what's up with that?
Thank you for the call, Deborah. Stuart, what is up with that?
Yeah, that's right. Fresh garlic is quite a different beast to ground garlic. And what you'll find is that ground garlic, it's hotter, but its flavor is harsher. So maybe that's what you're finding. The thing that gives garlic its flavors is a substance. Well, the main substance is a substance called allicin. It doesn't really matter so much what it's called, but it only forms when the garlic clove is damaged or crushed. So what happens is that if you've got your fresh garlic and you crush it or you chop it, then that flavor only starts to grow over time. So really, you want to crush your garlic, set it aside, do the rest of your prep, then get your garlic, finish off chopping it and put it in with your cooking. Whereas when it's been ground, that the heat has already been kind of fully unleashed because it's been dried and ground into a powder, then put into a jar. So in that instance, ground garlic is hotter than the stuff that is fresh, but you lose a lot of the nuance. You lose a lot of the subtle flavors of garlic. It's a much simpler flavor profile when you use the ground garlic.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Does that explain it?
Yeah, definitely. Deborah, thanks for the call. Now, Dr. Stu, you shared a recipe with us. We have this at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's West African peanut curry. Yeah, it looks really good with Durban masala. Mm. Now, if people want to check out the recipe, that's all online. But it illustrates one of the things you do in the book. You go spice by spice, but you also go region by region and just talk about the kind of the spice toolkit of different regions. Can you tell us a little bit about the West African spice kit here?
Yeah, well, this is the first book that actually catalogues all the different spice blends in the different regions. Now, doing this is actually quite a difficult thing to do because I've not been to all the different regions of the world. And what you find is that when you go to a bookshop to get your cookbook, you'll have a chef and they'll be an expert in a particular region's cuisine. Or they won't be. They'll be a generalist and they'll do a bit of a curry and they'll do a bit of a stir fry. But if you want the real authentic thing, you really have to go to the regions and speak to the people there who cook with the stuff. So when we got this book, we had to source people from all over the world who live in West Africa, who live in Southern Africa, and who live in the Himalayan belt. All around the world, we kind of covered every region and get them to tell us what spices they actually use and give us examples of real authentic blends. So not the stuff that you're necessarily just going to find online, but the stuff that is actually used on the ground. And in West Africa, for example, there's some like peppercorn type spices called grains of Selim and grains of paradise. You can get them over here. They're slowly starting to come in, and they're we call them peppers because they're a bit like peppers, but they've got a lot more going on there. There's all kinds of different. There's kind of slightly floral flavors in there. There's the heat and there's the pepperiness. And so they use those spices. They use chili, they use ginger, and they use garlic. One thing that to bear in mind is that no longer really do we have one region of the world that has just its spice. We've all moved around the world, and that where spices once grew are now growing all over the world. So vanilla, for example, originally grew in Central America, and now Madagascar is the region where it's most prized for Madagascan vanilla. But in West Africa, for example, they're the spices that they use there. And this Durban masala originates from South Africa. And Durban is a place where there's a large Indian population there. And so this masala curry blend was birthed out of the Indian subpopulation in South Africa. And you often find this when people leave their original kind of location, their original culture, and they move somewhere else, they kind of take the best bits with them, and then they kind of morph it into the new land that they are. So if you've ever been to, if you ever have the fortune to get to Singapore, it is the most fantastic place in the world, I think, for cuisine, because you've got a hodgepodge. You've got Malays there, you've got Chinese there, you've got Indians there, you've got the Western influence there, and it all comes together and all these different ideas get thrown together and you get fantastic food. And this one here, you've got a West African peanut curry with the Southern Africa Durban masala. So you've got that kind of that Indian fiery curry thing brought into the West African cuisine.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Marcus. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. So my comment is I ended up in the same situation where I had the jars that got pushed to the back of the little cabinet and whatever else. And the spices got to a point where I thought they might be questionable as to their flavor. So I just started experimenting in my own home. And so I started with grilling like hamburgers, and I just actually sprinkle the seasonings onto the coals. I mean, I've done it with Lowry's seasoned salt. I put garlic salt on there sometimes. I love using like Italian seasoning. And now it's to the point where I actually sprinkle fresh because it produces a smoke in the grill. And so it's not necessarily exactly on the food, but it still gives it a touch of flavor that it wouldn't otherwise have. And so I found that as a good way to use up old spices.
That is a brilliant way to use it. I've never heard anybody use that before, and you're a genius, because that is a fantastic way to use spices, because the one reason why when you cook something over cold, it tastes different to if you cook it under your kitchen broiler, is because of the smoke, is because the flavor particles that are coming off the coals themselves. And if you've got your, like a big steak, and you've got it over in your over the coals, what happens is that the liquids, the fats and the liquids from the meat will come down when they hit the coals, it evaporates, and in that vapor, along with the smoke, there are all these flavor compounds, these flavor substances that are released, and they come and they waft the underside of the meat, and it gives you all these fantastic kind of barbecued kind of flavors. And you're absolutely right, in the same way that people put wood chips onto the barbecue, you can do the same thing with spices, and you've just discovered a fantastic way of getting rid of those old spices.
Marcus,
I'm
thanks
so
for
impressed.
Thanks
it's
for the call.
It's going in the next book.
Keep your face well clear, though. I've had that hot pepper hit a hot pan, and you know your eyes start watering. And yeah, let's go to another caller now. Carol is with us in Marshfield. Carol, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Carol?
Well, just a couple things. One, I've started using a lot of herbs and spices, not so it's spicier, extremely ethnic. But I was wondering if you'd speak a little about just your general health benefits, because I have not had a cold or the flu in 15 years. And also, I use old spices, outdated spices in potpourri to not throw them out.
Oh, okay. Potpourri, so you just smell them, but you're not cooking with them. But thanks for the call, Carol. Dr. Stu, are there health benefits to particular spices that we know about?
Now, I didn't go into the health of the health benefits of spices in the book itself. I just focused on the cooking. My background is I was trained originally as a medical doctor, but I wanted to just stick on the cooking. But that said, as I've said already, spices have been prized for their medicinal qualities. How much each individual spice benefits us, it's really difficult to prove. And whenever they try to do proper scientific experiments on it, it's very difficult to show any one individual spice having a profound effect. But spices, they're supercharged, flavor loaded little things. Those chemicals, those substances in there do appear to be beneficial for health. So particular ones like ginger, garlic and turmeric, they're all ones that have substances in that we think are beneficial to the immune system. So that would very much be in keeping that you got good health and you're having lots of spices in your food. It goes hand in hand. I'm wary, though, when people go the other way and they say that if you have this spice, it will cure you of dot, dot, dot. But there's definitely good things in spices, and great news that you're well because of spices. It's a double win.
Dr. Stu, in our last 20 seconds or so, is there a spice that's really been added to your toolkit based on your research for the book?
Oh, it has. It has. Search this one out. It's called wattle seed. It comes from Central Australia. You'll probably have to order it online. It is fantastic. It comes from a wattle tree used by the Aborigines. And the seeds are taken from pods. They're dried. They're roasted. It has the most wonderful smoky, woody, kind of beefy, almost meaty flavor. Hunt out wattle seed. Put it on your ribs. Put it on your steaks. It's fantastic.
Dr. Stu, thanks as always for joining us.
A pleasure. Nice to chat with you.
That was Dr. Stuart Faramond, food scientist and author of Spice, Understanding the Science of Spice, Creating Exciting New Blends and Revolutionize Your Cooking. We've been exploring the diverse world of cooking with spices. Find a new spicy recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. And I guess watch for roasted wattle seed to become the spice of 2019. Staying with our food theme, what is Wisconsin's favorite condiment? As reported in the USA Today, a consumer product review website looked at the highest rated condiments for each state. Now, this isn't about top sales, but what users of this particular site had to say about different condiments.
And the winner in Wisconsin was Hellman's mayonnaise.
I'm a big mayonnaise guy. There's a time in my life I didn't like it. I've really gotten into it for sandwiches, dips, aiolis, lots of stuff.
Yeah, I'm a fan of mayonnaise too. Not too much, but I am a fan. But like with all condiments, I'm a name brand guy. So Hellman's I stick with. I don't go with generic. I can't. Like with ketchup and mustard, I have to have a certain brand.
Well, now I think people love this recipe I gave a while back on Central Time. There was this product, you can buy a product now. This is big in Puerto Rico and elsewhere. Mayonnaise already combined with ketchup, right? You buy them together in a bottle.
Really?
Now here's a Durrell recipe for you to make it yourself.
Okay.
Spoon some mayonnaise onto your plate.
Okay.
You with me so far?
Yep.
Squirt some ketchup onto it, and then take a fork and stir it together. You've got mayo ketchup. It's brilliant. It's just that. But seriously, I love it on fried potatoes. It's the best. Have you ever done that?
No, I have never done that.
I recommend it highly. It is awesome.
I will try it.
All right. All your condiment news on Food Friday here on Central Time.